Welcome to Nightlife, a bite-size episode.
How should we talk about the conflict between the European settlers and local Aboriginal people in the early days of the Sydney colony? Most of us, of course, are aware that there was a lot of violence following the arrival of the First Fleet. Some people like to talk about that violence as a war or something else. And historically, of course, the conversation has been a bit complicated. Although I guess things are changing now. The concept of the frontier war is now pretty well accepted. And we're also starting to learn the stories of the Aboriginal warriors who fought it. The most famous of these resistance fighters was arguably Pemulwuy, a Wangal man of the Eora Nation. Pemulwuy waged a decade-long campaign against the colonists in Sydney, attaining a somewhat mythical status before he was eventually killed, rather gruesomely, his head sent to England. David Hunt's an historian and the author of Gert, The Unauthorised History of Australia, as well as True Gert. He's with us tonight to help tell Pemulwuy's story and also to paint a picture of Aboriginal resistance in the early colony. David, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
G'day, Philip. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. It's funny, really, isn't it? We grew up, and you know, I've remarked on this with other historians, we probably, you know more names of American Indian resistance leaders than we know of Aboriginal resistance leaders, of whom we know none, except for Pemulwuy.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, it was all Geronimo, you played cowboys and Indians.
Cochise, we knew all these
You
names.
Did. Sitting Bull.
Sitting Bull, exactly.
Yeah, so look, I think there's much more awareness now, and certainly the Australian school curriculum does look at frontier conflict in much more detail than did when I was a young whippersnapper.
Mm. Who was Pemulwuy, and do we know anything about him before colonisation at all?
Well, look, we know that he was probably about 40 years old at the time the First Fleet came through the heads in 1788. He'd been richly marked with a club. His foot had been injured. He had a fleck in his eye, and he had these markings of a wise man. So he was, or a karate. So he was respected within his community, both as a warrior and as a wise man or elder. Beyond that, all we know is that he had some tense relations with Bennelong, who is one of the other famous historical figures of the day.
Of course. Let's go to Bennelong in a moment. But where was Pemulwuy's country? Was it on the Cumberland Plain or the Hawkesbury? Or where was it?
So look, depending on who you ask, he's a Wangal man, he's a Bidjigal man. There's some dispute around whether the Bidjigal, around Botany Bay, are separate from the Bidjigal. But the smart money appears to be that his country ran from sort of the Lane Cove River, the back end of that, all the way into the Blue Mountains around Mount Victoria. So that took in the Cumberland Plains. It took in some of the rich land around the Nepean. And people of the rivers and the plains.
Mm. His story, as you say, intersects with the story of the only, the key other Aboriginal person we know at the time, Bennelong. Who has a very different history, but Pemulwuy and Bennelong don't get on. Why is that?
They don't get on because Bennelong, who Watkin Tench described as basically all his entire interests were love and war. He liked fighting and he liked women, and he had his heart set on Pemulwuy's daughter, Karabarabalu, and wanted to take her as a wife. And Pemulwuy was not terribly impressed, and there's actually an altercation which involves Bennelong being speared by Pemulwuy. So there was tension there, but there was also an ongoing relationship, and Pemulwuy, in some of his earliest interactions, was known to stay at Bennelong's hut. So tempestuous, but also an ongoing relationship.
So Bennelong actually asked the Marines to shoot Pemulwuy at one stage, in order to facilitate this marriage, did they?
Look, Bennelong was a very, very canny operator, and he saw the coming of the British as a way of increasing his own influence amongst his people. He regularly asked for food and for clothing and other things, and on several occasions asked that the Redcoats go and dispose of some of his rivals, of whom Pemulwuy was one. Philip never did that, but it didn't stop Bennelong from asking.
It's really when Pemulwuy speared Arthur Phillip's gamekeeper, John McIntyre, that things start to go downhill, don't they?
Look, it actually changed the course of Australian history, this one event.
What was this about?
Well, McIntyre was trigger happy on the cultural relations front. His job as a gamekeeper and as a hunter was to go out from the settled areas of Sydney and to hunt kangaroo predominantly.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd get into altercations with Eora people, the local Aboriginal people, who regarded this as their foodstuff. And so there was conflict over kangaroos, and McIntyre was believed by the Eora people to have shot some of them in disputes over game. And Pemulwuy was having none of this and spears McIntyre with a barbed spear. It took McIntyre about 2 weeks to die, a very, very painful death. And Philip, in retribution, orders a punitive party set out to bring him the heads of a couple of Aboriginal people in bags and to capture and hang 10 Aboriginal people. And Philip had always had tried to foster a relationship of peace and amity with the local Aboriginal people, but McIntyre's death led to a change. And after that, even though Tench and Dawes, Watkin Tench and William Dawes, who were the two most pro-Aboriginal officers in the colony, were given this task to go on this punishment raid, they didn't, or they didn't do so effectively, but that changed the relationship between
the Aboriginal people
and the colonists. Mm. Yeah,
I'm speaking with David Hunt, a historian, about the Aboriginal warrior Pemulwuy and what we know about him. So following the death of Arthur Phillip's gamekeeper, John McIntyre, things are different. And there are some serious conflicts that develop, particularly on the Cumberland Plain, aren't there?
Yeah. The Cumberland...
And these are really arguments about hunting grounds, I guess.
Hunting grounds and water. Mm. So the land that was most suited for agriculture and for grazing were the rich sort of floodplains around the Hawkesbury and the Nepean and on the Cumberland Plains. It was also the best ground for hunting. Mm. And so you have conflicts over land use. And Pemulwuy actually forges a coalition of people from a number of different Aboriginal groupings and launches a series of what we now describe as guerrilla attacks on predominantly sort of farmsteads and isolated communities out on the Cumberland Plain around Parramatta and its surrounds.
So prior to this, were settlers and convicts on the Cumberland Plain generally at peace with Aboriginal people?
You have, as soon as Cook comes through the heads, or comes into Botany Bay, sorry, you have a conflict with a couple of Gwagal men. There's an exchange of musket fire and spears and stones, and often contact in its initial phases, there was an element of violence there. So the violence tended to be isolated. It tended to respond to particular incursions or affronts. Pemulwuy changed that and created, if you like, a sustained campaign of resistance as opposed to sort of having a go when you were aggrieved by one particular thing.
There was quite a substantial conflict in 1797, wasn't there, when about 100 Aboriginal warriors faced off against the British in what we maybe now call the Battle of Parramatta. Tell me about that.
This was Pemulwuy's, if you like, his largest military action. Since 1792 and the death of McIntyre, he'd led these small-scale raids. This was taking it big time in a pretty serious way.
Mm.
So there were about 100 Aboriginal men attacked Parramatta.
What, the entire settlement?
They came in from the edge of the settlement with the aim of inflicting damage. There were redcoats and settlers present, and it didn't go terribly well for them, and Pemulwuy was captured in that particular skirmish.
Mm. He wasn't killed on the spot, though. He was...
No.
Although he'd been shot, he was allowed to recover, but then he escaped.
Well, the great thing about Pemulwuy was he had been shot so many times. He had over 8 ounces of lead in him after the Battle of Parramatta from a number of incidents. He was believed by settlers and his own people alike to have supernatural powers and to be immune from firearms. And because he was so respected by the colonists, instead of hanging him on the spot, which is what they would have done for somebody they didn't respect, they took him to hospital, they healed him up, they handcuffed him effectively to a bed. And even though he's terribly injured, he manages to break his shackles and decamp through a hospital window. He was a difficult man to pin down, Bamaway.
So he fought on for about another 4 years before... But how was he eventually caught and killed?
Well, Governor King, who replaced Governor Hunter, who never really got to grips with what was going on the plains, said, "I'm going to offer 20 gallons of rum and 2 suits of clothing to the man who brings me this bloke dead or alive." And he also ordered that the Aboriginal people be driven from the settled areas by firing on them.
Mm-hmm.
By this stage, a lot of Aboriginal people had lost access to their traditional food sources, and many of them had moved into town. And King effectively drives them out of town for the purpose of creating discontent amongst the Aboriginal people and having them inform on Pemulwuy and letting him know where they are. So it was a classic sort of occupying power strategy, mm-hmm. Combined with a bribe of 20 gallons of rum and a couple of suits of clothes. And it was Henry Hacking, after whom Port Hacking is named, who was a notorious alcoholic and had been a gamekeeper with McIntyre, who finally tracks Pemulwuy down and shoots him and brings his head back to the governor.
Where was that? Where did that take place?
That took place, I think, in the southern areas of what would now be Sydney rather than mm-hmm. up the river. I'm not entirely sure where. Yeah.
After his death, Pemulwuy's head is removed from his body and shipped to England.
And it's
a gruesome thing, isn't it?
Well, and it's incredibly gruesome, but Joseph Banks had been asking for human heads from Australia since the early 1790s. This is the golden age or the birth of the era of scientific racism, where you would collect skulls from people over the world, rub them, measure them, and try and make generalisations about people's abilities and character. And so the governor sends a letter to Joseph Banks with Pemulwuy's head pickled. "Although a terrible pest to the colony, Pemulwuy was a brave and independent character. Understanding that possession of a New Hollander's head is among the desiderata, I put it in spirits and forwarded by the Speedy." And so Pemulwuy, like many other Aboriginal people, and particularly Aboriginal resistance leaders, had his head sent off to Scotland.
Mm. Where is it now?
That is the big question.
Really? What we don't know?
We don't know. We know that it was originally in the Anthropological Museum of a Scotsman called Dr. John Hunter,
mm-hmm.
And then it goes missing. And I think there's been a movement for, really a strong movement since the 1970s, to repatriate Aboriginal body remains. And this one has particular significance. And Prince William has offered to find it, so it's bound to turn up soon. But it's probably sitting on a shelf somewhere without a proper label and has been long forgotten.
Yeah. Yes, it's, as you say, it probably ought to be back here in Australia if it's to be anywhere.
It should.
Hmm. David, terrific to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Philip.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.